Welcome, everyone, to a special two-part episode of the NBA podcast. We've reached the final week of the regular season. So in this first part, we're going to talk about some injuries. We'll say goodbye to the New Orleans Pelicans and the Detroit Pistons, both of whom have been eliminated from playoff contention. And then we'll talk about some of the fun stories that have gone around the NBA in the last week. Before we get underway here, just a reminder, you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. In our bio, you can find all three of our Twitter handles, so be sure to give us a follow as well. You can find us on iTunes this year, so we'd love it if you subscribe, download, leave some reviews. We'd love any feedback you could provide. And we're being hosted this year on FanRag Sports, so check them out on Twitter at FanRag Sports, and for their NBA content, at FanRag NBA. Zach Harper, formerly of CBS Sports, is writing for FanRag this year. He's been pumping out a lot of great stuff. We'll have a lot on the MVP talk. That will be in the second part of this special two-part episode, so be sure to check that out as well. But again, FanRag Sports on Twitter, at FanRag Sports. As always, I'm joined today by Morten Jensen and Sarah Chalea. How's it going, you two?
It's going well, Brian.
Pretty good.
Good to hear, good to hear. We're a week away from the playoffs, and both of your teams possibly... Well, Sarah, your team is definitely going to make it. Mort, your team seems like it's going to, for whatever reason.
My team? I'm not sure what you're referring to,
Brian. Oh, yeah. That's a good point. Everyone, be sure to check out Morton's column. It was on Bloggable, right?
Yeah, under the fan post section.
Yeah. Morton wrote a really good column this week where he made fun of me for calling the Bulls his team because he's ready for a trial separation, I think is the right term.
That is the most accurate description I've seen so far. Yeah.
Perfect. All right, guys. So let's talk about injuries, both good and bad news. And let's take the glass half full side first. We have some good news on the injury front. Kevin Durant has been cleared medically from the MCL sprain that he suffered in the end of February. He's supposed to be coming back Saturday against the Pelicans, barring a setback, according to ESPN's Chris Haynes. Steve Kerr has already said he's going to be on a minutes limit for these last three games of the season. So, Sarah, what do you want to see out of KD in these last three games? What should Warriors fans be particularly keeping an eye on?
It's so little time to really get back to their, you know, some of the issues that they had earlier in the season as far as, you know, chemistry closing games, which that was only slightly an issue when they had close games to begin with, and I doubt that they're going to have them. But really, all I would want to see is just him running around, getting up and down the court, feeling confident on the leg. I've seen him warming up in the recent weeks, and he looks damn good. He still rarely misses a shot, ever. So I would expect all that to be the same. Just, you know, get him in game shape, get him in some rhythm going into the playoffs. That's all I would care about.
That sounds right. Mort, do you have any other things you're looking for?
Oh, I'm not looking for anything. Just reps. I mean, it's Kevin Durant. He'll figure things out.
Yeah, I think that's the right take. Good for us for avoiding hot takes here. We'll have plenty of those in the second part. But yeah, I mean, I as you said, Sarah, it's three games. There's not that much time to get back into a rhythm and solve the issue, the chemistry issues or whatever, the late game closing, you know, hot potato they had. So it'll just be good. You know, I don't care what he does offensively. I just want to see if he's still got that defensive quickness and you know how the death lineup fares with him now, because Iguodala has been playing really well in his absence. So, you know, a couple weeks ago, we had expressed some concern about the Warriors. I think it's safe to say we are no longer on that boat. As long as KD doesn't suffer any setbacks, they're definitely entering the playoffs as the favorite. So, good luck to Warriors fans. We hope KD comes back healthy because, Sarah, even though you're a Spurs fan, I know ultimately you just want to see everyone healthy in the playoffs.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, so let's move on. Kyle Lowry was the other big injury return this week. He came back Wednesday, somewhat unexpectedly. The Raptors just made no mention of it, and then all of a sudden in pregame it was like, oh yeah, by the way, Kyle Lowry's playing tonight on the second night of a back-to-back. He fared really well. He put up 27 points, 10 assists, and 5 rebounds against the Detroit Pistons, effectively eliminating them from the playoffs. I mean, we've had this talk numerous times, even since the trade deadline, but given what has transpired in the last couple days, Boston getting their clocks cleaned by Cleveland and then losing to Atlanta Thursday night, the Wizards barely beating the Knicks and their defense looking a little shoddy in recent weeks. Otto Porter also hasn't been quite up to the level he was earlier in the season. And now Kyle Lowry is back in Toronto. So, Mort, who do you have as the biggest threat in the East to Cleveland?
That's a good question, because that Boston-Cavs game, right? I mean, look, they took a punch right in the teeth.
Yeah.
And look, let's be honest here. They should have tried to get Paul George and Jimmy Butler in there, because now it seems more necessary than it did just a couple of months back. They need that primary dude. And that people are going to read that as me saying Isaiah Thomas isn't that guy. But yeah, offensively he is, but you need to have like some type of true superstar wing with legit size who can play both ends of the court. Thomas, as much as I love him, is not a strong defender. So right. that's a huge concern. And it's also why I'm kind of iffy on Boston at this point. Mm-hmm. While Washington hasn't fared a hell of a lot better, I still like their makeup a lot. Like, with Bogdanović coming off the bench, and you still have the starting lineup intact. I mean, I'm not counting them out at all. But assuming Kyle Lowry keeps going the way that he's come back, like 27-10-5 is ridiculous. But yeah. if he performs like this, you know, the 22 points, the 8 assists, the multitude of freeze and whatever, and he meshes well with Ibaka, then Toronto has to be sort of my default option here. I mean, doesn't it? With him healthy and thriving, Toronto has to be that second team.
Yeah, I mean, I'm right with you. Sarah, are you joining us on the Toronto train?
Yeah, I mean, I'm tempted to say Wizards because they have played them so well, even though... strangely, they both kind of have defensive deficiencies right now. So, but maybe that's what makes them such a good matchup. But then if the Cavs find out how to defend, that could separate them in the playoffs. As we all know, once the regular season is over, it doesn't mean that much.
Right.
But yeah, I tend to agree. If Toronto gets healthy, I think they probably could pose the toughest challenge. Especially... you know, if they'd run that pick and roll with Valanciunas as often as I'd like them to, I'd support them a little more. But, you know, picking up Tucker and Ibaka, I think, gives them a better chance defensively. So that would give them the edge in my book.
Yeah, I think we're all in agreement here. You know, the fact they held serve without Lowry for this last month really speaks to, A, how good Corey Joseph is. But B, like, they're, you know, they just added an all-star a week before the playoffs, and they've already been, you know, they're probably going to finish with 50 wins this season, having been without him for a month. You know, I think the thing that alarmed me from the Boston game, and I'm pretty sure it was Avery Bradley who called this out afterward, he even said, like, look, LeBron just targeted Isaiah in pick and rolls. Like, he knew exactly what he wanted to do, and he just, like, went after this little 5'9" guy, which is the smart play. Of course you do that. You know, right now, ESPN.com has that real plus-minus metric. There are 467 qualifiers this season. Isaiah Thomas is dead last in defensive real plus-minus. So, I mean... you know, more as you were saying, offensively, he is that guy. He is that 25-point-per-game superstar scorer.
Damn near 30.
Right. But, you know, you want... if you could, like, mesh him with Jay Crowder, then you basically have your superstar. But because those two are separate entities, that's an issue. So, yeah, I'm with you both in thinking it goes... the hierarchy is Toronto, Washington, and then Boston. Mort, it looks like your Bulls, I mean, the race from 5 through 9 right now is completely convoluted. It could change at a moment's notice. But if the playoffs were to start today, your Bulls would be facing the Celtics in the first round. All right, sorry, not your Bulls, the Bulls.
That was twice, Brian.
Yeah. It's force of habit. How do you think the Bulls would fare against the Celtics?
Oh, man, they would probably lose pretty horridly because Boston seems to have their number. They smoked them the last time they played. It's ironically, it sounds so weird, right? But it's actually Cleveland that the Bulls should prefer to play just because they have their number in the regular season. And not that that suggests that they are a better team, but just because they would have like some sort of, they wouldn't have to come over this mental hurdle of playing the Cavs as they would Boston, because they remember that Boston has kicked their butts several times this year and done so pretty handedly. With Cleveland, that fear isn't there, I presume. Yeah. After game one, it might be a different matter, but,
right?
You know, so yeah, I think they would fear Boston quite a bit.
Yeah, so we will have a full playoff preview next week once the matchups are all set. But again, 5 through 9 is so, I think they're all separated by 2 games right now, so that could change at a moment's notice.
But could you imagine the subplot in a Boston Celtics Chicago Bulls series with Jimmy Butler there? And the whole trade thing, man. Yeah.
It would be super funny. I'm personally rooting for it to happen. I'm rooting for the Bulls to beat the Celtics. I really want the Celtics. No offense to Boston fans out there, but I really want the Celtics to get knocked out in the first round so Danny Ainge finally realizes, like, oh, maybe a 25% chance at Markelle Fultz wasn't worth getting, you know, my 50-win team knocked out and wasting a year. Like, Al Horford's not getting any younger. And Isaiah Thomas and Marcus Smart and Avery Bradley only have 1 year left on their contract. Like, maybe I should have pushed my chips in now.
I mean, I'll just quote James Holas.
Yeah.
Like, please. At the draft diary, we had a people breakdown last year.
Yeah.
Or when we had to do these fictitious trades and we were talking about Jimmy Butler. And I was asking him, like, how many picks would you give up to Jimmy for Jimmy? And he was like, Mort, take all the picks. Take all the damn picks.
Yeah.
That was just so fitting.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we will come back with more playoff analysis next week. Let's turn our attention now to 2 bad notes of injuries. First, Derrick Rose has a medial meniscus tear in his left knee. He underwent surgery Wednesday. He's expected to return to basketball activities within 3 to 6 weeks. The Knicks did not specify what type of surgery he had, but remember a couple episodes we had my wife Alex on to explain the difference. It sounds like, based on that timeline, it's a meniscectomy rather than a meniscal repair, which, you know, quicker recovery time, which is good for Rose because he's going to be a free agent in July. More risk of long-term complications down the line, particularly once he gets into his 30s. So, Mort, you know, this is the latest in a long history of knee injuries for Mr. Rose. What do you think it means for his free agent prospects? Where do you think he ends up? How long of a contract does he sign? How much is it worth?
Well, I definitely think it influences the amount of money that he's going to get paid. But I don't want to sleep on the fact that he's had, like, a quiet bounce back year.
Yeah.
I mean, we've made a lot of fun on the behalf of the Knicks, but we've sort of not touched on that Rose has played pretty well overall. He's had some issues fitting into the triangle. He's had some issues fitting in alongside Melo and Kristaps. So that's one thing. And he's not a playmaker. He probably never will be, but still 18 points a game. He's more or less stopped shooting the three, which is both good and bad, but like he realized that that was not part of his game. So he removed it. If it should reappear in the future when he gets like a better, if he becomes a better shooter, whether, you know, we don't know if that's going to be the case or not, then you can sort of revisit that. But in terms of the money this year and where he lands, no idea on where he lands. And I would guess that he's probably not going to be signed for more than 1 year that's fully guaranteed, unless it's like at a ridiculous discount. Like if he signs for a discount and he secured like 4 years, then I wouldn't even mind it. I mean, look, like 5 years or like 4 years, 20 mil, like sure.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, definitely, right? But he's probably not going to do that. He would probably opt for something like 1 year, 15, like a Jeff Green deal. Does that sound like out of reach?
No, that's where I'm thinking too. Or even like what Rondo did with the Kings 2 years ago, right. Even with the Bulls this past year. You know, 2 years, 28, maybe a couple million guaranteed the second year to protect in terms of injury.
Yeah,
I have pegged Sacramento as his landing spot for months now.
Yeah,
especially because Darren Collison and Ty Lawson are both going to be free agents. You have to assume they're going to get a point guard in the draft, but maybe they're going to want to bring in. You know, it all that was all before the Boogie trade. Maybe now they're like finally fully committed to a rebuild. So, like you, I have no idea where he ends up. I think a lot will just depend on, you know, the free agent movement of all the other big point guards. Like if Chris Paul, I don't think he's going to leave the Clippers, but if he does, suddenly they have what, like Raymond Felton and Austin Rivers as their top two point guards. Like right. Maybe Rose goes there, you know, maybe the Pelicans, if they lose Drew Holiday, suddenly you're looking at Tim Frazier as your top point guard.
But so Minnesota though?
I mean, yeah, we talked about Ricky this Rubio's last been week. Playing so well. Yeah.
Yeah. I know. Not necessarily as a starter, but like, Let's look at the facts here. He's injured again. He understands, and his representation understands, that this hurts his market value. Mm-hmm. And he also knows, by sheer experience, that the one guy who's really tapped into what he can do is Thibodeau.
Yeah.
And if we see Taj Gibson sign there, which we all kind of anticipate is going to happen... And by and large, like Minnesota would have to make some moves and whatnot. They are not as cap friendly as one would think they are.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, it would make kind of sense seeing Rose and Taj, you know, joining up forces alongside Tibbs. I mean, I wouldn't rule it out.
Yeah, and we can't rule out a return to New York either. You know, they've been very adamant about returning to the triangle next year, and Rose is not a big fan of the triangle, but if the Knicks decline Phil Jackson's team option, the triangle probably goes out the window. So we'll talk about the Knicks, we'll revisit them in a few minutes, but a lot is going to be hinging on both Phil Jackson and what happens with Carmelo Anthony. Before we get to Melo and the latest in the Melo drama, we need to talk about the other big injury of the week. Yusuf Nurkic, you know, we've been praising him for the last month, so naturally we gave him the podcast kiss of death. he has a non-displaced right leg fibular fracture that will keep him out for the remainder of the regular season. He was warming up Thursday night. The Blazers are still optimistic that he's going to be back for the playoffs. Right now they have a 1.5 game lead over the Denver Nuggets, so... barring a catastrophic collapse, they will be in. They have three home games remaining against Utah, San Antonio, and New Orleans. San Antonio has been resting players left and right, so we're assuming that Portland is going to make the playoffs. So, Sarah, if they do, assuming they do, do they have any chance of winning a single game if against the Warriors if Nurkic cannot make it back in time?
I hate to just say it's going to be a sweep, but yeah, that's the likelihood. I mean, I would give them a chance to win one game, but it would be a microscopic chance. Yeah. yeah, the Blazers are wonky. I mean, if they get hot from three, perhaps, but the Warriors are probably going to be hot from three, too.
Right.
And they have the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, so yeah, I don't see it happening.
How is that not their nickname? That should totally be... That's yeah. way better than Big Four.
Definitely.
Has it not been? I don't know. I don't think I made that up, but maybe I did. I may have seen that somewhere.
Okay.
Don't give me credit.
Okay. Well, I have not seen that, so I'm going to give you credit for it.
I will say that I'm bummed, because Nurkic was my favorite late season storyline.
Yeah,
it sucks, but...
Yeah.
What can you do? Hopefully you can come back in the playoffs. That would be fun.
Yeah, I one of my favorite things when they beat, so, you know, they were losing by like 15 to the Timberwolves on Thursday until Alan Crabb just went nuclear and hit like 7 threes in a row. And then afterward, Nurkic sent a tweet that was like a muscle arm, like one more step, and then a handshake or like a hand wave, which was pretty clearly intended for the Nuggets. And after the Portland beat the Nuggets the other night, he, you know, wished his former Nuggets teammates a good summer. So I am likewise enjoying shade throwing Nurkic because he has not been shy about his feelings toward the Denver organization.
Are they fair, though, when you think about it?
Were they fair to Nurkic?
I mean, the shade, really. I mean, I kind of understand why you choose Nikola Jokic over him. I get that he has to have, like, a lot of confidence and he has to believe that he is the best center every time he steps on the court, yada, yada, yada. But, I mean, look, I don't think Denver did anything wrong here.
No, I don't either. They didn't. I mean, they started Nurkic at the beginning of the season. They started both of them.
Right.
And then when they realized that wasn't working, they benched Jokic. They kept Nurkic in the starting lineup. And then Jokic outplayed him, moved into the starting lineup. Nurkic moped for 2 months and then got traded.
So, exactly. So, like, I get what you're saying, and it is fun to see him throw shade. I'm just like, dude. Just look at the facts for a little bit. But, I agree overall. I mean, look, I'm just going to throw you his raw numbers, and then I'm going to have you guess how many minutes he plays.
Okay.
15.2 points, 10.4 rebounds, 3.2 assists, 1.3 steals, 1.9 blocks. How many minutes? Because those are healthy numbers.
Yeah, with those, normally I would expect somewhere in the like 33 to 35 range.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're not though. 29.4. No, 29.2. Like less than 30. That's insane production.
Yeah, fantasy basketball owners, if you're listening, draft Yusuf Nurkic in the early rounds next year. He's going to be a monster.
Yeah.
Okay, so we are not optimistic about the Blazers' chance without Nurkic. Again, we'll do our playoff preview next week, so hopefully we'll have a better sense of whether he's back, and we can talk more about the schematics of that matchup. Let's move back to the Knicks for a second. Carmelo Anthony, speaking of throwing shade, Melo has basically, it sounds like his bags are packed and he's ready to leave New York. Mm-hmm. On March 29th, after a game where he had a reduced role, he told reporters, quote, "I see the writing on the wall. I see what it is. I see what they're trying to do, and it's just me accepting that." On Monday, he was talking with reporters about his upcoming exit meeting with Phil Jackson, and he said, quote, "The chips will be on the table in that meeting." So, Mort, do you think Carmelo Anthony is a Knick when free agency kicks off on July 1st?
No, but first things first, I want to be a fly on the wall for that exit meeting.
Yeah.
I mean.
I know.
Yeah. And like, could you just imagine, this could be a pay-per-view event. Like, him sitting across Phil Jackson over a small table. I mean, I would pay money to watch how that meeting would unfold. I mean, but no, I could actually see Anthony in Brooklyn. I know this has been talked about a little bit. Assuming they keep Brook Lopez around, like, Brooklyn could theoretically need a boost. They're not getting, like, they can't play for draft picks anyway.
Sure.
So I mean, if they give up like fairly nothing, I mean, why not?
Right. Yeah. I mean they they have two picks. They're probably going to be in the 20s this year. The earliest pick they could give up after that is in 2020 because their 2018 first rounder is going to the Celtics. Mm. But they've got a bunch of like young, intriguing, you know, they have like Caris LeVert and Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, Isaiah Whitehead, Sean Kilpatrick. Like, they've got
a few fodder things, right? And the thing is, I don't think that the Knicks can even demand a whole bunch in return because like they slaughtered Melo's trade value. Phil Jackson did that. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't even be surprised to see Melo get shipped for what is really like 10 cents on the dollar. He could be had for extremely little. And if you're Brooklyn, I'm just thinking, sure, why not? I mean, what do they possibly have to lose here?
Right, because as you said, they have no incentive to tank for a draft pick.
Exactly, next year. And they still need a scorer, and they still need a guy who can show all the youngsters there how to do it. And Melo, for all his faults, is still a fantastic scorer. He's still a phenomenal player. I could totally see this rubbing off positively for a lot of guys, like Caris LeVert, who you mentioned. Yeah. Isaiah Whitehead, who's like a natural scorer, but just needs to like learn how to play angles and whatnot. Like, Melo would be a godsend for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it will always, for wherever he goes, if he goes anywhere, it will always come down to the price. So, it, like, if I'm Brooklyn, I don't sell the farm for Carmelo Anthony.
Oh, right, right.
You know, who's not a long-term fixture of your future, especially when your talent pipeline is already pretty depleted and, you know, you're not going to get your first-round pick next year. But, yeah, if the Knicks were really willing to sell for, like, one of their two first-round picks this year and a first-round pick in 2020 and then, like, one of their young guys, like Sean Kilpatrick, and that's it. Yeah. Hell yeah, you make that deal.
Like Avante Hollis Jefferson and a second. Like, I mean, come on, just something. I mean, and look, that's the argument right there. Like, if New York is countering with, oh, this is Carmelo Anthony you were talking about, then the counter is, yes, it is, and you absolutely murdered every chance you had at getting something valuable back in return.
Yes. Well, he also, it is worth noting, he has a no-trade clause, so we don't know if Brooklyn would be on one of his teams, one of his list of approved teams. That said...
Well, he loves New York, though.
Yeah, that's true. And, I mean, it sounds like at least the Clippers, you know, depending what happens with Chris Paul and Blake Griffin and J.J. Redick, frankly, that could be a destination. The Bulls, if Dwayne Wade stays, that could be a destination. The Knicks will have options, presumably, and it sounds like Melo is so fed up with being a Knick that he might broaden his list of teams that, you know, I think at the trade deadline, it was literally only, like, Boston and the Clippers, which is, the Bulls and the Clippers. But now he might be more willing to move to a, who knows?
China. To a Chinese club. It's fine. Right. I don't care. Just get me out of here.
Yeah. Sarah, do you think Melo is on the move this summer?
Yeah, I do. But I just really, and this is probably a really niche reference, but I just kind of want him in that meeting to hire like a singing telegram to go with him and just have Ann Peebles' The Handwriting is on the Wall sung while he just kind of stares at Phil. Like, I wish we could play that in his podcast because it is a perfect song.
Oh my God.
I love that song so much. But yeah, just stare. I'll do it if he wants. He could just like give me a dollar. I just want to I'll sing it for him.
Yeah. All right, we need to. You should just tweet at him every single day with that recommendation.
Let me go with you, please.
Yeah,
we can do this.
Yeah,
I hate how we can't see or hear that meeting with Phil. Like, if this had been with the Bulls, at least the conversation would have been recorded.
Good point. Yeah. Wow. Don't worry, the Knicks are one of the leakiest organizations in sports, so you know within an hour of that meeting being done, like, Ramona Shelburne will have a full write-up of everything that was said from both sides.
Oh, that's true. She's fantastic, isn't she?
Yeah,
like,
I know.
She's done so many... Like, we haven't really given a shout-out to a whole bunch of the writers who just make amazing stories. Like, her story on the Lakers recently, oh my
that was
lord.
Really good.
I mean... this is a true story. I actually ran my bus stop to pass two places, like two destinations too far, because I was reading it and I didn't even realize where the hell I was. Like, that was just, I was totally caught up in it. So I went two bus stops too far. That was amazing. She's one of the best sports writers out there.
I was reading Chris Ballard's story. Sarah, you, I think, tweeted it, and that's how I saw it, the one about Monty Williams, which is phenomenal. Everyone, if you haven't read it yet, carve out 15 minutes. It's like just one of the most powerful pieces of NBA writing you will read probably ever. I was on the L yesterday going to pick up my car, and I damn near missed my stop because I was just so transfixed. So yeah, we'll give a shout out maybe next week as the playoffs start to all the NBA writers out there for doing a hell of a job this year.
Damn NBA writers making us miss our stops.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. All right, let's move on to our post-mortems. We have two this week. The Pelicans are officially eliminated from playoff contention, so we need to revisit the Boogie Brow tandem now that we have about a month's worth of sample size. So since acquiring Cousins, the Pelicans are only 10-11. But they have the 11th best net rating in the NBA. And in the 394 minutes Cousins and Davis have played together, they have a plus 2.8 net rating. So, Sarah, now that we've seen more of Boogie Brow, how are you feeling about the long-term fit of that duo?
I'm still not sure how I feel about it, honestly. I'd like to see them together for a whole year. It hasn't been especially encouraging, which is a little disconcerting, but we have said that they need shooting around them. They kind of have to hope that, like, a Seth Curry pops up again this summer that they can sign on the cheap. It's not been great, but I think we got to give Gentry a whole season with them and see what happens. And if he can't figure it out, then, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. But it has not been great and certainly could be better. And I think part of that is scheme, and part of it is, you know, like we've talked about, Boogie is extremely skilled and so good, but there's some of the other unglamorous sides of the game that he doesn't involve himself in as much, like defense.
Right.
So that would help if he would pull along on that side a little more.
Yeah. So Mort, I want you to weigh in both on Boogie Brow, and then also, you know, as Sarah mentioned, as we've talked about before, we'd like to see them acquire shooting somehow.
Yeah.
Problem is, they have $89 million of salary already on the books for next season, and that's not counting Drew Holiday, who's an unrestricted free agent. So if they're able to re-sign him, they're going to blow past the salary cap already. Then they're probably only going to have, like, the mid-level exception. They might even be, you know, depending on what happens, they could be close to the luxury tax already.
Right.
So what would you like to see them, like, how would you like to see them build around Boogie and Brow if you think that's the route they should go?
Well, I would see if they can move Solomon Hill for anything, honestly, that gives them cap relief. They probably won't be able to, because that was a, I'm not sure it was a panic signing, but it wasn't a good one. It was built off very small sample size where he played well, and then they sort of said, hey, you're worth, what, $52 million?
Yeah.
No. That turned out to be extremely false. So there are some, I was about to say bad apples, but that's unfair, bad apple contracts on the team that needs to go. So it's really a tricky situation. I kind of dig the Boogie Brow tandem on its potential. I mean, I've seen a fair bit of Pelicans since Boogie arrived, and Sarah just nailed it with the defense. He's really having a tough time grasping what they're doing out there, so he's trying to play a lot of one-on-one defense, and he's getting burned. His rotation patterns are just completely off, and I'm not sure. I think it's the scheme, because I didn't see this many flaws in Sacramento, so it could be a question of him just getting the reps in. But more than that, he seems frustrated again. And it's just like, I'm not sure what he's frustrated about. He's getting a lot of shots. He's getting the ball a ton. Like, it's pretty apparent that Davis is actually giving up the rock a lot more to him and allowing him the freedom to be himself. And it seems like that's not enough for Boogie. And I'm probably reading too much into that, but I don't know. I can't get a read on him here in New Orleans. Maybe it's because he's just not really over the whole situation. Like, he's a very emotional guy, and I could totally see him having to use, like, 6 months or more to just mentally move on from another place. It seems like he's really stuck on the mindset that Sacramento, they promised me all these things, and then they traded me, and I feel really betrayed. Like, he's a really emotional guy. I think if he had a tough coach around him, like Brad Stevens, and when I say tough, I don't necessarily mean that in a bad way, but a guy who holds him accountable, and a guy who can also, you know, put his arm around his shoulder and waist or whatever, and say, you know what, let's figure this thing out together. Like, that's the type of coach that he needs. So we'll see. But financially, they're not in a good place at all.
Yeah.
Which might force them down to life to break up this duo, and I don't want to see that happen quite yet. I want to see them get some serious shooting in there. Maybe each one more bounces back next year?
Yeah, so do you think it's just a matter of, you know, you were mentioning especially his defensive rotations have seemed off. Do you think it's just a matter of he needs a full training camp and preseason with this team, and then maybe next year they'll be better?
Well, you're going to have to give it a shot, right? I mean, it wouldn't hurt. It can't possibly hurt. Having a full training camp under your belt with a new team is more often than not a huge thing. Like, because everyone starts at basically the same page at training camp, because you have roster additions, you have some things that the coaching staff has picked up during the summer that, okay, we need to change this, we need to just tinker with this and that and whatever. And that's going to be introduced to the players at the start of training camp, and he's going to be a part of that. He's had the reps from finishing the year here with New Orleans. So I'm very optimistic about him accepting New Orleans and its system a lot more after a full training camp. So I'm not concerned as of yet. But, I mean, if he has a bad start next year, like the first 30 games next year, that's going to be the big issue.
Yeah,
that's going to be that little time period where I'm going to just be glued to the screen to see if, like, where his head is at.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I'm still cautiously optimistic about this duo. You know, you've seen some games where both of them just, they feed off of each other, and they're just, like, both are so unstoppable that if Alvin Gentry can figure out a way, like, there should never be a single second of the game where both of those guys are off the court. Like, always, all 48 minutes, they should have one of them, so then you always have that, like, unstoppable player. Like, again, I'm going back to the Timberwolves-Blazers game on Thursday, but the second Karl-Anthony Towns stepped off the court, the Blazers would go on a run, and then he'd come back on, and the Wolves would stem the bleeding. Like, that's what Cousins and Brow give New Orleans. Like, there should not be a time where both of those guys are off the court. So you should shouldn't have these teams going on runs because, oh, all right, like, Anthony Davis isn't protecting the rim anymore. It is going to be tough for them to build around. I like the idea of moving Solomon Hill. It seems like, you know, they built last year's roster with this defensive mentality, figuring we're going to build around Anthony Davis and Drew Holiday, but now you acquire DeMarcus Cousins. You have to completely throw out your old roster construction, and now we're building around these two bigs. So, you know, now we just need to line three-point shooters around them. The decision to waive Omri Caspi is going to come back to haunt them. He would have been a perfect fit for that roster, and he was signed relatively, I think it was like $6 million a year. It was not a huge contract. You know, they might have to consider using the stretch provision on Omer Asik, who still has 2 years left on his deal. That would, they'd waive him and they'd pay him about $5 million annually for the next half decade. But, you know, Cousins is a free agent after next season, so that would hurt. But, like, if it's the difference between getting Ashik's cap hold off the books quicker and getting shooting so you could actually see if this Cousins-Brow tandem is viable long-term, you're going to have to do the latter. So it's going to be a very interesting offseason with the Pelicans, starting with lottery night, because if they keep their top three pick, or if their pick falls within the top three, they get to keep it. And then Drew Holiday's free agency, we'll see who else they can pick up, but it's going to be, I'm very, like you, Mort, I will be tuning in to Pelicans games nightly once the 2017-18 season starts.
Just one note, it has sort of a Philly Iverson vibe to it, the whole thing, right? Remember when it was just Iverson and a bunch of defenders? It seemed like that was the plan New Orleans went for with Davis. Like, you had this one superstar, and then they just surrounded with a bunch of scrappy guys, like each one more. That's a scrappy signing, right?
Right.
And then Philly kind of realized, like, the following year, oh, we need another scorer. So they got, like, I think it was Derek Coleman.
Mm-hmm.
And then the year after, it was Keith Van Horn. Like, they tried to pilfer these scorers next to Iverson. Like, okay, now you have a scorer, and it just didn't work out.
Yeah.
But so it's kind of interesting to see. This is like the Iverson / Melo years, just in New Orleans. Like,
right.
It's kind of an interesting subplot there. Like, if they can coexist long-term, or if it's just going to be, like, the same results over and over, just with two guys instead.
Yeah, it's a good point. Yeah. All right, let's turn our attention now to the Pistons, who I am sorely disappointed in this year. I had them pretty firmly in the playoffs, and Reggie Jackson's knee injury, or he has left knee tendonitis. He missed the first month of the season after undergoing a PRP injection on it. It sounds like he was just never right the whole year, so it's hard to fault him for, you know, how bad the Pistons were with him on the court, but they had bottom five offensive and defensive ratings with him on the court. They played a lot better with Ish Smith. Sarah, I want to ask you about Andre Drummond, because that's the one, you know, knock on wood, Reggie Jackson's going to come back healthy next year, and he might not be as good as he was in 2015-2016, but he's not. I don't think he'll be as bad as he was this year. Andre Drummond's the one I'm concerned about, though, because he's, you know, he's 23. He's still got plenty of time. It's way too early to write him off entirely, but he's showing some signs of stagnation that concern me. What are you thinking about Andre Drummond? Do you think he still has the potential to become that, you know, the Shaq of the Shaq of the Dwight Howard of the Pistons, like the guy who anchors a Stan Van Gundy 4-out, 1-in offense?
I don't know. I'm down on him too. I'd love more your response.
No, that was to you. Like the sound, that was just so fitting.
Yeah, that's all I've got. No, I agree that it's always a little worrisome to see the stagnation that you alluded to. He didn't really take any steps forward this year. Personally, I think I wouldn't bring back the core that they have right now. I would blow it up and build around Boban. I think that's the way to go. Yeah, no, it was a very disappointing season for them. I, too, thought they were going to be playoff contenders. I liked what they did last year, and yeah, it's always scary when you go backwards. Sure, some of that can go to Reggie's knee, but, you know, like you said, I don't know how healthy he was even when he came back, but the fact that when he came back, he kind of blew up their chemistry, too, is not good. So right. I don't even know if, you know, if I'd be more concerned about Drummond or Jackson at this point. Probably Jackson.
Yeah, that's a good point. Where do you stand on the blow things up trade? Do you think it's time for Stan Van Gundy to take a sledgehammer to this roster? Worth noting, of course, that Kentavious Caldwell-Pope will be a restricted free agent in July. He's probably going to get $100 million or more. The Nets and the Sixers are both rumored to be interested in him. You know, he might... It's possible he gets a max deal. So if you're the Pistons, do you match whatever he gets and bring this core back and hope Jackson comes back healthy and Drummond improves? Or are you like Sarah? Is it time to blow things up?
Yeah, I'm probably going to ask whatever team signs KCP to an offer sheet. Is there any chance you're willing to do a sign and trade? Because I'm not really digging the whole roster. Here's the thing about Drummond, because I agree with you guys. I am wildly concerned about Andre Drummond. Like, I thought he was on his way to becoming, like, an elite shot blocker, an elite defender, whilst being an amazing rebounder. And, Brian, you nailed it. He's stagnated. Like, he's even declined a little bit. His scoring game has not gotten better. His rebounding is always excellent, so that's, like, the one thing that we can't never knock him for. But his defense is just... It's a big old meh. It's pretty average. He can, on occasion, provide some really nice games where he does everything correctly, which just adds to the frustration level.
Right.
And then the free throw shooting. Just remember when I actually gave his free throw shooting a crush earlier this year. And, yeah, I guess I doomed it because it's back down again to 38, almost 39%, which is horrid. So there's two ways to go about this. You could look at it and say, well, we have one of the league's absolute top rebounders who can also score in double digits, who has some serious flaws, but we can keep him. He'll be a second star or a first star, whatever, and then he's that one. He's at least one piece we don't have to worry about. Or you can say, what's his value right now? Are there teams out there who's willing to give up like a significant draft pick? Mm-hmm. Or a significant young player who has the potential to be even more than him? And if so, you got to consider it at this point. I'm inclined to say the sledgehammer, and then with the possibility of keeping Drummond around. But if he's like the guy who can make or break a rebuild through his value, then I'm going to have to pull the hard choice here and say, yeah, he's got to go.
Yeah. So Zach Lowe of ESPN wrote about the Pistons, I think right around the All-Star break, before the trade deadline. He reported that the Pistons had quietly explored the trade market for both Jackson and Drummond. He said they were disappointed in the return. So here's what concerns me about Drummond. Two things, frankly. One, and Zach Lowe mentioned this in a recent 10 Things I Like and Don't Like column, and one of the don't likes was Andre Drummond post-game, because they just keep feeding him the ball, and Zach had a great description where it's basically like, this is what you're expected to do with a franchise player, but it just feels like they're wasting possessions at this point, because he's shooting, like, I think it's around 43% on post-ups this year. He's only scoring on 37%. He draws fouls on less than 10% of the time he gets the ball in the post. And it's probably because he's shooting free throws at 39%. You know, he's not even a good free throw shooter. He's an awful free throw shooter. So he doesn't want to draw contact. And so then instead of, like, going up strong to the basket, he takes these stupid hook shots. Like, he backs a guy down in the post one-on-one, does a turnaround hook shot that, like, oftentimes just looks terrible, just coming off of his hand, doesn't have much of a chance of succeeding. If he develops that post game and he learns, hey, it's fine to shoot 1 of 6 from the free throw line, at least I'm, you know, at least I'm having a chance to score those first 2 points, so that it's an and one, that would help offensively. I think, you know, I'm sure the Pistons are feeding him that much because they figure, hey, game reps are the only way he's going to get better, and I'm not ruling out the possibility of him becoming more consistent with those hook shots, but I would like to see him dial that down at least until, you know, you see some sort of progress there. Defensively is where I'm concerned, because as you mentioned, Mort, the shot blocking is just not there. Like, he was blocking, I think, close to 2 shots a game 2 years ago, down to 1.1 this year, right? Like, it's a career low rate. Even by, his minutes are slightly down from last year, but even if you go on a per 36-minute basis, still a career low rate. People are shooting really well against him within 6 feet. I think it's around 55%, which is not what you want from your rim protector. You know, like Joel Embiid, they're shooting 41% against. You can't build around a guy as your primary rim protector if he's not going to actually protect the rim. So that's the big concern for me. I'm inclined to say you give it one more shot and you see if Jackson can come back healthy. Like, you match whatever KCP offer sheet gets this summer. But if Jackson doesn't come back healthy, if Drummond doesn't show any signs of improvement, then you have a quick trigger next season. You're ready to blow things up in December, because, you know, waiting until the trade deadline's not going to help you at all. But a lot of those guys are signed long term, so there's not a huge rush. It's not like they're going to lose all of their value on the trade market. their poor play would be what deteriorates their trade value rather than an expiring contract. But, yeah, I mean, they showed such signs of hope 2 years ago. So I just think, you hope Jackson puts this knee stuff behind him. And he gave an interview the other day where he was like, you know, I've seen some silver linings in the season. I think it's actually teaching me that I have to diversify the way I play, and kind of, like, he ran the most pick and rolls in the league in 2015-2016, so maybe he dials that back and becomes more diverse offensively. So I'd want to see this core one more time before making a decision, but I can understand why you guys are just you're done with these Pistons, because they were very disappointing. If you want more on the Pistons, I've got a column going out soon on B-Ball Breakdown about them, which has a lot on Jackson and Drummond. But yeah, Mort,
yeah,
hit me.
So, yeah, regarding Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, let me ask you guys something. Mm-hmm. Right now, he's projected to, you know, earn $20 million a year.
Yep.
Had he posted this stat line at age 27, as opposed at age 23, he would probably not have gotten more than, like, $5 million a year. I don't think so. Not in today's climate.
Like, Evan Turner just got 4 years, $70 million.
Right, but, like, who bid against, you know, Portland there?
Yeah, right.
I think the whole restricted free agency is kind of messing with people's heads. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, he's young, ergo he's got a whole bunch of potential. I'm right. not paying Kentavious Caldwell-Pope $20 million a year for 14 points, 3 rebounds, 2.5 assists, and 40% from the field.
Yeah.
I'm just not. I know he's strong defensively, and that's right. fine, but I'm not paying $20 million for it. We're talking about Drummond, who's a bad defender and somewhat decent on-ball scorer, open scorer, like when, you know, he's not being fouled or taking a hook shot. Like, he's okay. Right. Like, he can't score. So why would I want the opposite? A guy who is struggling mightily offensively, but it's just okay. You know, okay, he's more than okay defensively. He's good defensively, but he is not even average offensively speaking.
Yeah. Well, so he did hurt his rotator cuff, and he missed a couple games in January. Like, before that, he was actually doing really. If you look at his scoring splits before that injury and after. He's far more inconsistent afterward than he was before. He was actually, you know, he looked like a max player earlier this year, and then he got hurt, and then it's been kind of a mess.
Really? But then, the max player? Do you really think so?
In this climate, I mean, like, you know, there are very few guys who I think are like, you know, we didn't think Harrison Barnes was a max player. Basically, you're hoping what happened with Harrison Barnes last year, he put up, you know, paltry numbers with Golden State in, you know, a relatively small role. He goes to Dallas. He becomes one of their primary scorers. He blows up, has a great year. You're hoping that same thing for KCP. But as you mentioned, Mort, because he's so solid defensively, I would feel more comfortable giving him a max than I did, like, you know, than Evan Turner getting $70 million or even Alan Crabb getting $75 million. I think there is enough difference between KCP and Crabbe that extra $25 million or whatever, you know, that contract could come back to haunt you, no doubt. But I would be very surprised if he does not get a max this summer. I frankly think it'll be from the Nets. I don't know if the Sixers would go full max, but the Nets, you know, they proved last summer.
Yeah,
Sean Marks is super aggressive in restricted free agency, so it would not surprise me at all.
Yeah, I'm not feeling it because of, like, not just this year, but also his career numbers. He's not been a high-efficiency scorer. And, like, to your point about Harrison Barnes, well, Barnes was kind of buried behind Steph Curry and Klay Thompson. Like, KCP's not buried behind anyone. He's had every chance to, like, break out and hasn't done so. So that's kind of why I'm hesitant. But, like, I get the defensive part because he is a terrific defender. You know, good to terrific. On any given night. He seems to have that on-off button as well once in a while, though. But, I wouldn't give him that much money at all. I would actually, if I could, I would see if I can get some sort of rookie instead. I think a solid rookie could put up the same offensive numbers, not provide the same defensive impact, but if you get a guy with some level of defensive potential, I'll rather have that.
Yeah,
and see what I can get.
Yeah. And Detroit, it's worth noting, they have their first round pick this year is probably going to fall 10, 11, 12 range. Probably, I'm guessing Malik Monk will be off the board by then. So, they're, like, I guess Terrence Ferguson is probably the next best shooting guard prospect. Mm. Yeah, exactly. so, they Sorry, might Terrence. Have to go in free agency. But, like, you know, a guy like J.J. Redick for 3 years, $36 million might make more sense than KCP for 4 years and 100.
Like that.
Yeah, Redick is the guy who I don't think there's any chance he stays with the Clippers this summer. And I think whoever gets him is going to get him on a pretty good deal.
Derrick Rose and J.J. Redick in Detroit. I'm calling it.
All right.
Derrick wants to go back home. He can't go to Chicago. Milwaukee doesn't want him. Detroit is like something that's fairly close by. Why not?
Yeah, it's only a 4-hour drive. That's good. All right, let's move into our Where Amazing Happened segment, where, frankly, one of the most amazing things that's happened since we've started recording happened this week. Russell Westbrook tied Oscar Robertson's triple-double record, and for a single season, he has 41 on the year. Worth noting, we are recording this on Friday. The Westbrook and the Thunder play the Suns tonight. So, frankly, by the time you listen to this, there's a very good chance that he will have passed that triple-double record. He is also 6 assists away on the season for having a triple-double average on the year, which is just...
ridiculous.
Yeah, there are no words to describe what Russell Westbrook has done this year. So we're going to table any legacy talk and whatnot until the second part of this episode where we delve into the MVP race, but we wanted to give a shout-out to Russ for... I mean, just one of the most unbelievable seasons we've seen in any of our lifetimes. All right, so let's now go to the other big story in my world this week. Georgetown, 2 weeks after firing John Thompson III, hired Patrick Ewing as its head coach. I'm going to alley-oop this one to myself because, well, I'm a Georgetown alum, and I dealt with 10 years of missing the NCAA tournament.
And a showboater, so that's fitting.
Yeah, right. That too. So here are my thoughts on Patty, and then I'm going to throw it to you guys as well. You know, the things that I've heard, everything I've heard from him has me encouraged. There is definitely concern about, look, he's never had a head coaching job of any kind before, so that's a worry. He doesn't, you know, he hasn't worked in college. He's been in the NBA for the last 15 years. So he's worked with young guys, you know, he's worked with guys who just came into the league, but he hasn't dealt with the recruiting trail and the AAU circuit and all of that nonsense, which is a whole different world. So I think a lot of his success is going to come down to the guys he hires as his assistants, because it sounds like those are the guys who really put in the legwork, and then he can close the deal. The Georgetown's roster is just totally ravaged right now. LJ Peak, their best player from last season, has declared for the draft, and I think he's hired an agent. Sounds like he's not coming back. Tremont Waters, their best recruit for next year, just asked out of his letter of intent, and Georgetown granted it. So they have... frankly, if you brought in Greg Popovich to this roster next year, they were still going to suck. Like, it's going to be a very tough year. But that said, the fact that he, you know, I forget where I read this, but apparently during his job interview, one of the people interviewing him was asking, like, hey, well, would you run the offense that Stephen Curry and the Golden State Warriors run? He's like, well, no, because I don't have Stephen Curry. So he's, you know, he's approaching it with a very realistic mindset. He's saying, like, we're going to run a pro-style offense, which, you know, in all likelihood means a lot more pick and roll than you're used to from Georgetown under John Thompson III. They had the Princeton offense, which, when it worked, worked beautifully. Like, the 2006 and 2007 seasons, that was some of the best basketball I've seen Georgetown play in the last 12 years. You know, they... Those some of my fondest memories from college are Georgetown basketball games when they beat undefeated number one Duke with J.J. Redick and Sheldon Williams, when they knocked off UNC in the Elite Eight. They, you know, swept the Big East regular season, Big East tournament in 2007. That said, Thompson's system just never really seemed to... when it doesn't work, when you don't have the right guys running it, when you don't have an Otto Porter or a Jeff Green or a Greg Monroe... it goes downhill very quickly, and it turns into four dudes standing around the three-point arc, passing aimlessly back and forth until one of them just takes a shot because they don't know what else to do. So I'm glad to see Pat is going to run more of what he's used to in the NBA. I think Adrian Wojnarowski, or I don't remember who reported this, but apparently he's big on analytics, and as an assistant in the NBA, you would expect as much. You know, the inexperience is the big... question in the recruiting, but I'm hopeful that it works out for Big Pat because, you know, frankly, he's deserved this job for a long time, right, Mort?
Yeah, he has, and I'm not really worried about the recruiting.
Oh, hi, that's good.
I'm Patrick Ewing.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly.
I hope so, but, like, do kids these days know who he is, do you think?
Well, thank you, Brian. You just made me feel old as
I mean, you know, he played in 85. Like, or he played in college. He played
okay,
in
now, you're being harsh. That was his rookie year, though. Like, people have to remember. Well, maybe not, now that I think about it. Like,
It's
what,
been
what,
like,
what are the kids' ages like being recruited to college?
I think
like,
the legacy is there. I think that matters. Yeah, they probably didn't watch him that much.
Oh my god, I'm so old.
I mean, that is my question. Do people know? Like, yeah, I think the legacy. Like, you hear Patrick Ewing and you know who's a great basketball player, but like, you know, I'm thinking back to like Giannis and Jason Kidd earlier in the year, where it, like we heard that story where Giannis was like. Mm-hmm. Jason Kidd like yelled at him. He's like, "Oh, what the hell did Jason Kidd ever do?" And he looked up his stats on Basketball Reference. He's like, "Oh, okay, all right, you can yell at me. That's fine."
Then fine. Patrick is gonna go to these recruiting meetings, whatever, and he's gonna have a printed out page of his Basketball Reference.
Yeah, right.
There you go.
Here you go, kid. Look at what I did, and look at the bottom of that page. Look at what college I attended. Like,
right.
Or better yet, that would work on kids today. Look how much money I earned thanks to going to Georgetown. That was the school that prepared me to earn, you know, X amount of money.
That's a
and
good point.
In today's market, you can earn a hell of a lot more. Come join me.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, apparently he was on the Dan Patrick show, I think, Thursday, and he was like, oh yeah, I'm going to use AI however I can, like in recruiting. He's like, I know this kid in Connecticut who is... The guy who just decommitted, he's like, he's a big Allen Iverson fan. I'm going to try to get them on the phone together, which is a recruiting violation. So
he might need to brush
up. Yeah, apparently. So he might need to brush up on those rules. But yeah, I mean, it seems like he's going to use the Georgetown legacy to his benefit. Like, I'm sure he could call up Alonzo Mourning, Dikembe Mutombo, Iverson, Sleepy Floyd, like a lot of those legends and get. You know, reach these guys, but my question is just like, do they know who any of them are outside of Allen Iverson?
Oh, wait, I have a good hook.
Okay.
I have a very good hook here.
Please hit me.
So he leans into one of his recruits here and he goes, you know who one of my best friends are? Who? Michael Jordan.
Oh, that's true. That is very true. Yeah. I mean, that's what's got me excited. Just the. From Steve Clifford and the Van Gundys, they have just said such positive things about Pat and his work ethic, and, you know, there's always this, like, it's, like, a weirdly racist undertone where it's, like, I don't know if he, like, knows, if he's, like, put enough thought into this job or if he knows what he's getting into. It's, like, he's a grown-ass man, like, of course he does. Like, he, you know, what does that even mean? So,
and his basketball IQ as well was off the charge, I should say.
Right.
Yeah, it was, like, and like it was insane.
The sum of the Hornets, you know, he always gets, like, they try to pigeonhole him as a big man coach. And he's like, no, I'm going to, like, a lot of the Hornets players, I think Batum especially, said, like, yeah, I've talked with him. He's, like, really smart. Like, he sees the floor very well, and he sees things that he can teach me. That, you know, that you wouldn't expect necessarily from a 7-footer, but yeah, I mean, let's
all handle the ball. He was used to being on the perimeter as well. I mean, geez,
yeah. So let's all knock on wood that Big Pat fares well at Georgetown. Yeah,
I like it. He's deserved it. Like so many years on the bench. I mean,
Okay.
You could do a lot worse than a guy though who's passionate about your program too. So
that's true.
They're going to be fine. He knows the game. He wants to be there. They'll be all right.
Yeah, that's a very good point. All right, let's move on to the Orlando Magic, the weekly embarrassment of the Orlando Magic.
So gorgeous.
This week, they signed someone to a 10-day contract to bring him in at the end of the year. His agent tweeted a photo of him signing said contract. In the background of that photo was a whiteboard, seemingly with the Orlando Magic's trade free agency targets this summer. Guys, I'm going to throw this one to you first because I know one in particular stood out to you. But what of this board caught your eye?
Aaron Gordon for Dario Saric? Are you kidding me? Like,
yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Look, I mean, I get that Aaron Gordon had a lot of hype, a lot of potential. He probably still does, but like, as of right now, Saric just projects as like the clear-cut winner of the two. Mm-hmm. And I mean, look, isn't Gordon up for an extension like next year as well?
He sure is.
It's not even going to be cost-effective either.
Right.
Why would Philly even consider moving a guy who is cost control for another 2 years, I want to say?
I mean, he's locked in through 2019-2020. So Gordon has, he has an extra 2 years on Gordon.
Right, because he did not pull a Nikola Mirotic and stay 3 years. So he's actually bound to the rookie scale. So that's another 3 years.
Yeah.
Why? Oh, Orlando's going to Orlando, huh?
Yeah.
That's just, But, I mean, at least the names on that whiteboard were agile bigs and, you know, combo forwards and guy who could shoot. It's like new era guys. So that's something.
Yeah.
It was like the Aaron Gordon idea that was like, are you kidding me? What kind of value do you think he has?
Yeah. I don't want to jinx it because God knows Brian Colangelo could. I'm not gonna say anything about that. I think you brought up the financial aspect of why that's especially dumb, but I'm never gonna rule out Brian Colangelo doing something crazy. Sarah, did anything on this board make you laugh?
Just like the whole situation was funny, but it was also mortifying. Like, I, you know, live in fear of ways to get fired. And my God, of course, we think that came from an agent, but God, you got to be careful when you point your camera these days. And other than that, I would just like them to keep their paws off Davis Bertans. That's it. Yes. That's all I care about.
Yes.
Leave him alone.
He did show up on the list as they put an Anderson on there, and I'm wondering if that's Kyle Anderson or Justin Anderson. Either way, one of us is going to get mad. Nico Mirotic is also on there. The thing I like, they have two J Greens, so it's not clear which one is Jeff and which one's Jamichael, but one of them has an X next to his name, which I'd love to know like what that is. That is, if that's Jeff Green, does that mean like nope? We did it once. Nope. We learned our lesson.
That actually seems somewhat realistic, doesn't it?
I know, right? Doesn't it? But, yeah, to your point, Mort, I am encouraged, you know, looking at this list. Like, they've got Wilson Chandler, Stanley Johnson, Tobias Harris, Marcus Morris, Gallinari, Iguodala, James Johnson.
Wilson Chandler.
Yeah.
Orlando. I could dig that.
Rudy Gay, Caspi, PJ Tucker, like they've got a lot of those, as you mentioned, like those nice two-way wing, like the small forward types that you can put next to Aaron Gordon. It seems like, assuming they don't trade him for Dario Saric, they are committed to keeping him at the four. It only took them 3 years to realize that was the best play. Oh, so if you want a preview of what the Orlando Magic are going to do this summer, just Google Orlando Magic whiteboard and you'll have a good idea. All right, last thing we need to touch on this week. It seems like the quote-unquote unwritten rules of the NBA have suddenly become a big story. Lance Stephenson, who we talked about last week, what to expect when he came back to the Pacers. We forgot to mention we expected him to incite a riot, because he nearly did that against the Raptors the other night. The Pacers are up like 15 points already. There are 3 seconds left of the game, and Lance dribbles down the court and goes in for a layup. So then P.J. Tucker and DeMar DeRozan get in his face. DeRozan got ejected for his second technical foul. I think Lance and P.J. Tucker each got a technical. We also recently had JaVale McGee shooting a late three against the Wizards in a blowout, which Brandon Jennings took offense to. So, Sarah, you've been around the NBA a lot in the last couple of years. So I want to ask, is this a thing? Is this like, do players really care about this? Or is this just a weird coincidence that we've had two instances in the last week or so?
I mean, it's definitely an unwritten rule. Generally, I don't feel like NBA players take their unwritten rules quite as seriously as like baseball players do, but then again, what's happened this week makes that seem completely false. People have been deadly serious. PJ Tucker was pissed.
Yeah,
he was right in Lance's the back of his head, because Lance was just walking away, like they weren't even there. Yep. Yeah, but no, it's pretty amazing. But NBA players do care about it. I know there was an incident, I think it was all the way back in 2014 already, in Portland, where Nick Batum shot a late three, and he just kind of threw it up, you know, because sometimes it depends on the shot clock. I think it's fine if the shot clock, even if you're up, if the shot clock's going to go off, you can kind of throw it and hope it goes off the rim. And it's not a huge deal, but it happened to go in. And Tim Duncan gave him the best look ever. I'll have to tweet it out because I found the picture.
Oh, nice.
It was a perfect, somebody got the perfect picture of Batum kind of smiling and Tim looking back like, all right. But it was beautiful. And it's worth mentioning that I do remember Batum like immediately apologized after the game and said, that's the worst thing I've ever done on a basketball court. And this is after he had already punched somebody in the balls in the Olympics. So worth noting that apparently that is a worse offense in the basketball world. So there what do go. I know?
Yeah. There you go. Mort, where do you stand on this unwritten rule nonsense?
Well, I'm European, so we play until the clock buzzes.
Okay.
Yeah, we really don't, you know, dribble the ball out. Some teams have begun to do so because of the NBA, which is kind of weird.
Oh, wow.
And then you have the coaches on the sideline like, what are you doing? So I have a whole different mentality to it. And I think it's kind of fun because can we agree on something that I'm hoping I'm not going to step on anyone's toes here, but American ball players are more focused on stats than Europeans are. Is that a fair assumption for the most part?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah, especially younger guys.
Yeah. So if we apply that logic, it's kind of ironic that players in Spain and France and just overall, you know, all over Europe are like, let me get that last bucket in. And
yeah.
in the NBA, where every stat matters, apparently, is like, nope, I'm just going to dribble it out instead of launching this wide open three. Like, I would assume, like most youngsters, which is like, I would like to add those 3 points to my total.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's kind of fun. But no, I think it's ridiculous. Play. I mean, if you don't want to get shown up or whatever the hell these players think,
right,
then play defense. Stop the dude from scoring. I don't care. Just as long as nobody gets hurt on the last play, then I'm okay.
Yeah. I just don't understand why it matters. Like, it's not like a margin of victory thing. It's not like college football where margin of victory matters. Like, it doesn't matter if you lose by 15 or 17. So if Lance...
Right.
Hits that last layup, like, who cares? This just seems crazy to me that, as you mentioned, Sarah, like, PJ Tucker was all up in Lance's face the second that he, you know, Lance started running down the court, and then DeRozan and PJ Tucker, like, converged on him just to yell at him. So, weird.
Damn
weird.
You, we lost by 40 instead of 38. Like,
right.
Yeah,
it's like,
it's
you're
so
down
weird.
15, who cares? Okay, let's move into our crushes of the week. These are guys who do not get the attention that they deserve. Sarah, let's start with your crush of the week.
Well, I went with guys who had big games last night.
Okay.
So Taurean Prince.
Yes.
Who I think it was said that he's another one of my favorite late-game storylines, or late-season storylines. Yeah, Nurkic was number one, but other than that, the only thing worth following late in the season is young players who start to get more minutes and respond well.
Mm-hmm.
And he's one of those guys. He's had six starts in a row, and in those six starts, he's averaging nearly 14 points per game, five rebounds, 3.5 steals.
Yeah, yeah.
Shooting pretty well, so excited for him. Definitely looking like he's going to be a good player. And I wanted to give a standing ovation to Alan Crabb.
Yes.
Who went off last night. 8 of 10 from 3 in the comeback victory over Minnesota to help them sort of solidify their playoff positioning a little more. But he's really been one of few reliable three-point options for the Blazers all year. He's shooting 44% for the season from 3. He's got a career high in makes, 134. And also, I think the Blazers PR tweeted out last night at some point that before he went off, he was 3 of 3 at that point from 3, and they said he had 120 makes off the bench, which
wow.
was 5th in the NBA at the time. So
yeah.
And then he made 7 more that night, so yeah, definitely top 5 3-point shooter off the bench, so good for him.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, that was a big win for the Blazers too, as we mentioned earlier. Like, they could have been a half game up on the Nuggets. I mean, their end of season schedule is a lot easier than the Nuggets, so it probably wouldn't have made a difference. But yeah, kudos to Crab, and I'm glad you brought up Torian Prince. I just wrote a fantasy column for FanRag about streamers to focus on this weekend, and he's in there for awesome. I think for the steals, because you know it could be that Paul Millsap's injury, there is like knee soreness or whatever he had, that could end up being a blessing in disguise, because now we're seeing Prince. He has a legitimate role in that rotation. Like, he needs to be a factor in the playoffs, and I'm not going to say he's going to swing a series either way, but the fact that they have more confidence in him and he has more confidence in himself could be a big boost to Atlanta. So, good call on Prince, Sarah.
You guys are welcome, because that's my fault. It's all thanks to me, because I actually complained about him a couple of weeks ago on my Danish podcast.
Oh, good.
And after... Well, he started averaging 14-5.
Yeah.
Good work. So, yeah.
Kudos.
Perfect timing.
Right. Who are you going to complain about this week?
I'm not going to complain about anyone. I'm actually going to show some love to one guy who deserves it, who has gone under the radar, and that's my fault.
Oh.
Yeah, okay. So, I'm going to be honest here. We've talked a lot about the Bulls. And I've used every chance I've had to really just crab on them and whatever. And I believe all the things I've said. I agree I think that they are horrible managed, all these things, but what have gone under the radar, and that's my fault, I've not shown Jimmy the love that he deserves. We have not talked about Jimmy Butler enough. Whenever the conversation about Chicago has risen, we've talked about their crappy ownership, crappy management, whatever. But we haven't stopped to really discuss the kind of season that Jimmy Butler has had. He's been freaking amazing. And if he had been on a better team right now, he would have been an MVP candidate. Mm-hmm. This guy is averaging almost 24 points a game, over 6 rebounds and 5.5 assists. Prior to last season, he said some things that most Bulls fans laughed at. Like, I think I'm a point guard, he said. And Bulls fans were like, yeah, right. Well, crap, he is. High point, Jimmy. I mean, look, he is so great at handling the ball and getting guys involved. He's like a defensive-minded James Harden.
Yeah.
And I know you love James, Brian, but I would say that under the right circumstances, I think he could be even better.
Wow.
Like, if you surround him with the right type of guys, like, he's already better defensively by a freaking mile.
Oh yeah.
Like the offense and the offensive part, like, you know, it's not, the gap is large, yes, but it's not that large.
It's so definitely narrowing, yeah.
Right. So, and he's a great rebounder like James, and he's a great passer like James. He's not averaging 11 assists, but right. In the right system, he could easily average 7.5, 8.
Yeah.
Over the last week, he's averaged 28.4. 6 boards, 6.5 assists, shooting 53 from the field, 64% from downtown, and 84% from the line. And his free throw shooting is a story for this season. 9 free throw attempts a night at 86% accuracy. And for a guy who is that high volume of a scorer, that high volume of a passer, he only averages 2.1 turnovers per game.
Wow.
Jimmy is really much like Kawhi in that sense. Like, he's not mistake throw at all. Mm-hmm. He's a very secure player, and whenever he's given a chance to expand his role, he does it without like increasing all the negative numbers a whole bunch. So some love thrown Jimmy's way, because he deserves it. The Bulls don't, but Jimmy does.
Do you know, I nearly picked him. So I'm glad that you did.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, I felt like he was overdue for some love, too.
Yeah, we really haven't talked about him. And that's on me, because every time the Bulls come up, I've been like, screw him. And that's partially meant that I've said, screw, let's talk about Jimmy as well. So let's get into some Jimmy talk at some point later on. Maybe even in the MVP debate we're going to have.
Yes.
Just for funsies.
I really thought you were going to go with Rajon Rondo there, so I'm disappointed in you.
No. You know what? I can give credit where credit is due, but Rondo, I'm not going to go there.
He's been playing well lately.
I don't care, Brian. That's just going to make the Bulls keep him.
That's true. That's fair. All right. I'm going to go with the guy who Jimmy Butler murdered on Thursday night, and that is Timothée Luwawu-Cabarrot of the Sixers.
God, he got owned so bad.
Yeah, he got worked. I mean, so in the... Oh, wait. First, I need to give a shout-out, actually, to the Sixers medical staff. I forgot. That's my real crush of the week, because we've already... Embiid and Simmons have been out for the year for a while. Okafor got shut down recently with knee soreness, like a year after undergoing surgery that should not have had lingering effects the entire year. Robert Covington now has a torn meniscus, and he played on that, presumably, for at least a little while. Now Dario Saric has plantar fasciitis, and not only are they letting, they're letting him play, they're putting a 24-minute restriction on him, but they're letting him play through this, which is just so damn absurd, because he's like the only good player we have left that's still standing, and these games mean nothing. Like, it actually helps the Sixers to lose every game. So, kudos, Sixers medical staff. You've had a bang-up year. Keep up the good work. That said, let me go back to TLC. You know, he's only shooting 40% over his last six games, but he's playing 36 minutes because Covington is now joining the torn meniscus club. That said, he's averaging almost 17 points, 5 rebounds, 2 assists, 2 threes, and a steal in those 36 minutes. So, you know, I was really high on the guy when the Sixers got him. He was the 24th pick this past year. I didn't think he was going to play a huge role, at, you know, early in the year, and he frankly didn't. But because of Covington's injury, he's had a chance to kind of show what he's can do late. I think, you know, they've got him locked up on a rookie deal for 3 more years. I think he's going to be a factor in this rotation. I don't know if he's going to be the starting shooting guard next year. They still have Gerald Henderson, possibly, and Nick Stauskas, so he's got competition, but he's showing signs that he's going to be a late-round steal. And in this draft class, where a lot of the guys have frankly underperformed compared to expectations, seeing these flashes from him late in the year has me very optimistic about.
I'm gonna call Sixers. You Sean Spicer though.
Why? Did you not hear me just crap all over the Sixers medical staff?
Yeah, I did. But about Luwawu, you said he was, you know, knocking down 2 threes a game over the last 5. That's true, but you kind of neglected the fact that he takes 8 per game.
Right.
He's shooting 22.5% in that stretch.
Yeah, that's fine. It still counts. He's hitting them. He's hit more threes in the last 6 games than Jahlil Okafor has in 2 years. So he's more of a modern basketball player than the former number 3 overall pick. And I already picked Rashawn Holmes. I already picked Rashawn Holmes a couple weeks ago, so I couldn't use him. So kudos to the TLC.
I like him, so that's a good one.
Yeah, yeah. All right. That will wrap things up for the first part of this episode. Again, be sure there will be a second part coming out soon where we're finally going to have our long-awaited award debates, so check that out as well. Until then, be sure to check us out on Twitter at at the NBA Pod. Again, you can find all 3 of our Twitter handles in the bio as well. You can find us this year on iTunes, so subscribe, download, we'd love any feedback. And follow FanRag Sports on Twitter at FanRag Sports, and then for their NBA content at FanRag NBA. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined by Morten Jensen and Sarah Chalea. Have a good one, you two.
Likewise, Brian.
See you soon.
All right. Bye, guys.